same time, if you have pressure, what kind of negotiations are they? You know, we need to have negotiations without pressure. That's not negotiation with pressure. So the threats that they're making against our people, these brutal sanctions, economic sanctions that they have imposed, this is not the issue of negotiations that we're talking about.
6 rounds of talks on restoring the deal have so far been held in Austria's capital, Vienna, since April. The discussions are aimed at bringing the U.S. and Iran back to full compliance after Washington unilaterally abandoned the deal, and Tehran retaliated by scaling back its own commitments. The U.S. seeks a broader deal that would include Iran's missile program. But Tehran doesn't buy any such notion as negotiation for the sake of negotiation, says Iran's foreign ministry spokesman in his weekly briefing.
The Vienna talks are aimed at ensuring Iran's rights under the nuclear deal, which were violated by the U.S. lack of commitment and Europe's inaction toward the deal. So we are not negotiating a new deal.
Under the deal signed in 2015 between Iran and the 6 world powers, Tehran agreed to curb its nuclear activities in exchange for sanctions relief. In 2018, ex-U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew his country from the deal and reinstated sanctions on Iran. Tehran, in return, moved away from some of its obligations and resumed uranium enrichment to 20% purity. In the Vienna talks, Tehran vowed to reverse all of its retaliatory steps on the condition that Washington removes all its anti-Iran sanctions.
The new Iranian administration has not given any specific date as to when it will return to the Vienna talks. But what's clear is that the fate of the nuclear deal is equally important for Raisi as it was for the previous government. Except it's not the first priority for the new Iranian president, as he doubts the U.S.'s sincerity in lifting the sanctions after 6 rounds of fruitless talks. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Another wide-scale operation was launched by the Yemeni army against the oil giant Aramco in several areas in Saudi Arabia. The spokesman of the Yemeni army said Yemen's air force has successfully targeted Aramco's oil facilities in Ras Tanura in Dammam with 8 drones of Samathri type and a ballistic missile.
Our forces have targeted Aramco oil facilities in Ras Tanura in the Dammam region, eastern Saudi Arabia, with 8 Samad 3 drones and a Zulfiqar ballistic missile.
Saria also added that Aramco's facilities in Jeddah, Jazan and Najran were also successfully hit by 5 ballistic missiles and 2 drones of Samathri type. He then warned Riyadh against further attacks until the war on Yemen is stopped. Earlier, Saudi officials said they had intercepted ballistic missiles targeting eastern province as well as the cities of Najran and Jazan in the south. The attacks came in response to the years-long Saudi aggression against Yemen.
Yemen's army has no way but to intensify its attacks against Saudi Arabia amid the kingdom's aggression against the impoverished nation. Saudi Arabia uses all capabilities, targeting civilian areas in Yemen, destroying the country's infrastructures. The latest attacks by the Yemeni army serve as a tit-for-tat operation.
Saudi Arabia launched a deadly war against Yemen in March 2015, killing tens of thousands of civilians, most of them women and children, and displacing millions more.
People here hailed the Yemeni army for its retaliatory attacks on Saudi Arabia. They say Saudi Arabia will remain a legitimate target for them as long as it continues its aggression against the impoverished nation. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Across the world, the Afghan crisis continues to be a major talking point. It's no different here in the EU's de facto capital, Brussels. Members of the public have been sharing their views with Press TV.
I think they should leave the country and try for themselves to come out of it.
We should not intervene sometimes in proposing democracy or the sorts of political situations where they're not in, where when the country is not ready.
Especially the United States did in this country. It makes it worse, I think.
Now they are taking all of the materials, but I think as a global community we should interfere, but to stop that.
Power and interference always go together.
Anti-war campaigners are furious at remarks made by EU Foreign Policy Chief Joseph Borrell last Thursday. He said Afghanistan proves the need for an expanded EU military force, more commonly referred to as the EU Army.
We have to step up our integrated approach, combining military, civilian, development and diplomatic efforts.
We have been speaking to citizens about Afghans who are desperate to seek asylum. EU leaders, they don't want more refugees. Do you think we should take more refugees in?
Yes, he needs. He needs to take more refugees because these people is in bad situation in their country.
Belgian people or European people say that we don't have any enough place, but I think we have.
We must take refugees because all the people are on the same world. We are the same world.
They need to offer that help, and I believe that they need to offer a place to stay because they have nowhere else to stay.
The policy of occupying nations against their will certainly didn't go well in Afghanistan. Top EU officials and also prime ministers in the 27-country bloc are saying lessons must be learned. A good start, critics argue, would be for the EU to stop responding how high when Washington shouts, jump. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Among the seven Iranian COVID vaccines, COVPARS is making a name for itself. Developed by Razi Serum and Vaccine Research Institute, the recombinant vaccine started the third human trial phase on Sunday.
In this phase, we are going to have 40,000 people in two groups, one receiving Sinopharm and the other Razi COVPARS. We are going to compare the number of people who are going to get sick in each group, and by comparing with each other, what we are hoping to show is that the efficacy of our vaccine is at least the same as the Sinopharm.
Iran has so far vaccinated roughly 10% of its population. This as the resurgence of the coronavirus in more lethal forms, like the Delta variant, has been killing an average of around 500 Iranians every day in the past month. As the government is scrambling to import more vaccines, COVPARS authorities say they're working to get an emergency use license to help speed up the inoculation program.
Given the restrictions imposed by U.S. sanctions on the way of vaccine imports to Iran, we need to boost our domestic production of COVID vaccines. So we are expecting that COVPARS will get the emergency use license halfway through the third trial stage.
COVPARS is administered in three doses, two intramuscular shots 21 days apart, and one intranasal shot 1 month after the second dose. COVPARS says if all goes based on the plan, the vaccine will hit the market in 6 months.
As the coronavirus keeps transforming into wilder variants, COVPARS developers say they've already launched their production line to speed up the vaccination process. The biotech firm says as soon as it gets the emergency use license, it will kick off mass production with a capacity of 3 million doses per month. Yusuf Jalali, Alborz Province.
Taliban have deployed more troops and military hardware to the northeastern Panjshir Valley to take the last remaining territory in Afghanistan from the National Resistance Front, headed by Ahmed Massoud, the son of Afghanistan's national hero, Ahmad Shah Massoud. Massoud has called for a negotiated settlement with the Taliban, but has said his forces will resist if the narrow and mountainous valley is attacked. Meanwhile, some top political leaders urge both sides to set aside differences and resume a meaningful negotiation in a bid to avoid dangerous scenarios, mainly the loss of civilian lives in Panjshir, as well as a spread of armed resistance across the rest of provinces.
The only way of the ongoing situation in Panjshir is to simultaneously resume meaningful negotiations and continue resistance against any totalitarian policy to pave the way for establishment of an inclusive government.
This is while the expansion of war has forced hundreds of local villagers to flee their houses. They call on the international community and especially the UN to convince both sides to resume negotiations.
The war has forced us to flee our village and come to Kabul. I have 5 children. We have nowhere to go but city parks. We want peace. Our children should take up their education in a calm atmosphere. So I want Massoud and Taliban to stop their war machines.
The possible fall of Panjshir Valley into the hands of Taliban will bring the entire country under the rule of Taliban for the first time, as they couldn't capture Panjshir Valley during their first rule in Afghanistan before their collapse in 2001.
The war on Panjshir has turned into a big headache for the Taliban. Moreover, the group's leaders have so far failed to reach an agreement on the formation of the new government in Kabul. The Taliban have postponed the move again, saying they need more time for final consultations among the group's top leaders. Syed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
A high-level Lebanese ministerial and security delegation has arrived in Damascus. Deputy Prime Minister of the Lebanese caretaker government, Zeina Akkar, who holds several other positions, headed the delegation, which included the ministers of energy and finance, as well as head of the General Directorate of General Security. They were welcomed by Syria's foreign minister at the Jdeidah Tiabous crossing. The delegation held talks with several Syrian officials at once at the foreign ministry, namely the Syrian ministers of foreign affairs, finance, and oil. Talks focused on economic cooperation and Lebanon's need of Syria's help in transferring gas for generating electricity.
The two sides discussed the difficult circumstances they are living in, especially the electricity and gas sectors. The Lebanese side asked Syria to help Lebanon in transferring Egyptian gas and Jordanian electricity through Syrian territories. The Syrian side welcomed our request and expressed Syria's readiness to assist.
Both sides agreed to follow up the technical aspects and details of implementation through a joint technical team. Observers believe such a visit was only possible due to the U.S. backing of a plan that ensures Lebanon obtains gas.
I think Lebanon got a green light from the U.S. for such a visit. The Syrian government conveyed a message to the Lebanese side that it has accepted their request. I think the matter now is in the hands of Lebanon to get a regional and international approval for Syria's participation in pumping gas to Lebanon, as there are U.S. and EU economic sanctions on Syria.
Lebanon is seeking to revive a 2009 deal which stipulated that Egypt transfers millions of cubic meters of gas annually to Syria through Jordan, while Syria pumps the same amount to Lebanon. This is Lebanese officials' most significant visit to Syria since the start of the crisis in 2011. Lebanon, which remained relatively neutral towards Syria for so long, seems to have no other option now in light of its economic slowdown but to fully reactivate its cooperation and relations with Syria in hopes of some economic relief. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Streets remain deserted and business establishments closed in all major towns and the capital city of Indian-administered Kashmir for the second day after the death of the region's veteran separatist leader, Syed Ali Gilani. Indian forces continued a strong presence to prevent anti-government protests and enforce a strict lockdown. The authorities had also imposed near-total communication blockade across Kashmir as a precautionary measure to maintain law and order. On Friday, additional deployments were made to prevent people from holding anti-government protests after the Friday prayers.
Gilani, the most powerful separatist leader in Kashmir who spent many years in different jails, died on Wednesday evening at his Srinagar residence, where he had remained incarcerated for the past decade.
As the news of his death spread far and wide, authorities swung into action and sealed the roads leading to Gilani's Haidarpura residence. Security was beefed up across the region, barricades erected, and key roads sealed, calling and internet services were shut. According to his family members, the former lawmaker, who after quitting electoral politics in late 1980s had for years spearheaded the separatist movement in Kashmir, had desired to be buried in Srinagar's historic martyrs' graveyard. But the family members alleged that police forcibly took away his body and in a quiet funeral, buried him in a graveyard near his residence.
He passed away late evening. We live in his neighborhood. We were neither allowed to visit his residence to pay him last respect, not allowed to participate in his funeral sitting COVID. This is very unfortunate. It will hurt us forever.
We wanted to spare in the funeral procession of our leader, but we were not allowed by forces. He was hurriedly buried, and no one was allowed to say him the final goodbye. At least we should have been allowed to offer funeral prayers.
Known for his pro-Pakistan stance, Gilani led several anti-India protests and marches. He became a household name during 2008 and 2010 public uprising in Kashmir. A staunch advocate of Kashmir's right to self-determination, Gilani had stepped down as Hurriyat Conference chairman after he suffered with ailing health. He was conferred Pakistan's highest civilian honor in 2020. His death has been widely condoled, with Pakistan's Premier Imran Khan describing him as, quote, Mujahid-e-Kashmir. Meanwhile, police spokesman has said that there has been no incident of violence or protest in Kashmir after Gilani's death. Kashmir has been a bone of contention between India and Pakistan. Both the nations claim the region in full, but rule it in parts. Sidri Safib, Indian administered Kashmir.
Limelight. Expanded unemployment benefits that have kept millions of Americans afloat during the pandemic expired on Monday, 6th of September, setting up an abrupt cutoff of assistance to 7.5 million people as the Delta variant of the coronavirus rattles the pandemic recovery. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Jim Tankersley and Ben Castleman. The piece is titled, Unemployment Benefits Expire for Millions Without Pushback from Biden. Expanded unemployment benefits that have kept millions of Americans afloat during the pandemic expired on Monday, 6th of September, setting an abrupt cutoff of assistance to 7.5 million people as the Delta variant of the coronavirus rattles the pandemic recovery. The end of the aid came without objection from President Biden and his top economic advisors, who have become caught in a political fight over the benefits and are now banking on other federal help and an autumn pickup in hiring to keep vulnerable families from foreclosure and food lines. The $1.9 trillion economic aid package President Biden signed back in March included extended and expanded benefits for unemployed workers, like a $300 per week federal supplement to state jobless payments, additional weeks of assistance for the long-term unemployed, and the extension of a special program to provide benefits to so-called gig workers who traditionally do not qualify for unemployment benefits. The expiration date reached on Monday, 6th of September, means that 7.5 million people will lose their benefits entirely, and another 3 million people will lose the $300 weekly supplement. Republicans and small business owners have assailed efforts to extend the aid, contending that it has held back the economic recovery and fueled a labor shortage by discouraging people from looking for work. Liberal Democrats and progressive groups have pushed for another round of aid, saying millions of Americans remain vulnerable and in need of help. President Biden and his advisors have pointedly refused to call on Congress to extend the benefits further, a decision that reflects the prevailing view of the state of the recovery inside the administration and the president's desire to focus on winning support for his broader economic agenda. The president's most senior economic advisers say the economy is in the process of completing a handoff between the federal assistance and the labor market. As support from the March stimulus law wanes, they say more and more Americans are set to return to work, drawing paychecks that will power consumer spending in the place of government aid. And President Biden is pushing Congress this month to pass two measures that constitute a multi-trillion dollar agenda focused on long-run economic growth: a bipartisan infrastructure bill and a larger partisan spending bill with investments in childcare, education, carbon reduction, and much more. That push leaves no political oxygen for an additional short-term aid bill, which White House officials insist the economy does not need. Administration officials say money that continues to flow to Americans from the March law, including new monthly payments to parents, will continue to sustain the social safety net, even as the expanded federal jobless aid expires. President Biden has called on certain states, those with high unemployment rates and a willingness to continue aid to jobless workers, to use state relief funds from the March law to help the long-term unemployed. So far, no state has said it plans to do so. On Sunday, President Biden's chief of staff, Ron Klein, told CNN's State of the Union program that the March law was also allowing states to help those out of work by offering employment bonuses and job training and job counseling. "We think the jobs are there," Ron Klein said, "and we think the states have the resources they need to move people from unemployment to employment." President Biden has faced criticism from both the left and the right on the issue, and he has responded with a balancing act, supporting the benefits as approved by Congress, but declining to push to extend them, or to defend them against attacks by leaders in some states. Throughout the summer months, business lobbyists and Republican lawmakers called on the president to cut off the benefits early, blaming them for the difficulties some businesses were facing in hiring workers, particularly in lower-paying industries such as the hospitality industry. Soon after the backlash began, President Biden defended the benefits but called on the Labor Department to ensure that unemployed workers who declined job offers would lose their aid. But roughly half of the states, nearly all of them led by Republican governors, moved to cut off benefits early on their own. President Biden and his administration did not fight them, angering progressives. The administration is essentially extending that policy into the fall by calling on only winning states to fill in for expired assistance. "I don't think we necessarily need a blanket policy for unemployment benefits at this point around the country," Labor Secretary Martin Walsh said in an interview on Friday, "because states are in different places." Privately, some administration officials have expressed openness to the idea that economic research will eventually show that the benefits had some sort of chilling effect on workers' decisions to take jobs. Critics of the extra unemployment benefits have argued that they are discouraging people from returning to work at a time when there are a record number of job openings and many businesses are struggling to hire. Evidence so far suggests that programs are playing at most a limited role in keeping people out of the workforce. States that ended the benefits early, for example, have seen little, if any, pickup in hiring relative to the rest of the country. Even in the industries that have had the hardest time finding workers, many people don't expect a sudden surge in job applications once the benefits expire. Other factors, childcare challenges, fear of the virus, accumulated savings from previous waves of federal assistance, and a broader rethinking on work preferences in the wake of the pandemic are also playing a role in keeping people out of work. I think it's a piece of the puzzle, but I don't think it's the big piece, said Ben Felicia, the Director of Operations and Strategy for the Pennsylvania Restaurant and Lodging Association. It's easy to point to, but I don't think it's the true reason. Progressives in and outside of Congress have grown frustrated with the administration's approach to the benefits, warning it could backfire economically. Job growth slowed in August as the Delta variant spread across the country. Millions of jobless workers are going to suffer when benefits expire on Monday, 6th of September, and it didn't need to be this way, said Senator Ron Wyden, Democrat from Oregon and the chairman of the Finance Committee. Senator Ron Wyden added, "It's clear from economic and health conditions on the ground that we shouldn't be cutting off benefits now." Elizabeth Ananat, a Barnard College economist who has been studying the impact of the pandemic on low-wage workers, said that cutting off benefits now, when the Delta variant of the coronavirus has threatened to set back the recovery, was a threat to both workers and the broader economy. Elizabeth Ananat added, "We've got this fragile economic recovery, and now we're going to cut income from people who need it, and we're pulling back dollars out of an economy that is still pretty unsteady." Elizabeth Ananat has been tracking a group of about 1,000 low-income parents in Philadelphia, all of whom were working before the pandemic. More than half lost their jobs early in the pandemic last year. By this summer, 72% were working, reflecting the strong rebound in the economy as a whole. But that still left 28% of the group who were unemployed, either because they could not find work or because of childcare or other responsibilities. "We're going into new school year where there's going to be a lot of more uncertainty than there was this spring for parents," Ms. Ananat said. Employers are again going to be dealing with a situation where they have people who want to work, but what the heck are they supposed to do when their kids get sent home to quarantine?
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sesby. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Once again, Tel Aviv has spoken of expediting preparations to take military action against Iran. The Army Chief says an increase in the military budget has been earmarked to that end. And this is not the first time that Israel is threatening Iran. Defense Minister Benny Gantz also said last month that we are at a point where we need to take military action against Iran. The main objective, he said, is minimizing Iranian presence in the Middle East region with an emphasis on Syria. Now, how serious are these threats? And why is Tel Aviv repeating its belligerent rhetoric against Iran? To begin with, let's go to Mona Kandil and Ramallah, and let's see what she has regarding the media reaction and all these Israeli threats that are being repeated regarding Iran again and again. Mona, over to you.
Well, that's right. First, Israel's Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, said that issued the threats against Iran, saying that Israel may have to take military action against Iran. And following a series of threats from Israeli high-level officials over Iran's program, now here comes new statements and new threats and warnings from Israel's chief of chief general of staff, Aviv Kohavi, saying that preparations for possible action against Iran are being intensified and that the Israeli military plans dealing with Iran's nuclear program have been greatly accelerated. And as you have mentioned, he's saying that the main objective is to minimize Iran's role in the Middle East, saying that they will not allow any role for Iran in the Middle East, mainly namely Syria. And he said this would also be in a way or another against Hamas movement and Hezbollah as well.
Okay, thanks for that, Mona Kandil, our correspondent in Ramallah. Joining me in tonight's edition of the Spotlight today are from the Answer Coalition, we'll have Richard Baker, who's joining us out of San Francisco. Political commentator and peace activist Brian Terrell from Malloy, Iowa.
This is the Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the show, both gentlemen. Now let's go to Richard. Richard, is this hot air or military action against Iran is in the offing?
Well, there's always the element of psychological warfare that Israel carries out in hostility toward other countries in the region. I think that there is a danger of stepped-up military action. There's really military action going on. We can see by the bombings that have taken place inside Iran, the assassination of Iranian scientists and other figures, the step up of military buildup by the United States as well as Israel around Iran. So there is a very real danger of this. And of course, Israel has been opposed to the JCPOA toward any kind of an agreement with Iran, because what it really wants is a U.S.-backed or and a U.S.-Israeli war against that country to reduce its influence and to devastate the country, because Israel seeks to be the lone military power in the region.
Now, let me ask Brian this. Brian, on what basis is Tel Aviv accusing Tehran of destabilizing the region by pursuing its nuclear program? Evidence like the funny cartoon that the former Israeli prime minister showed the United Nations a few years ago, or what?
Yeah, well, it's to talk about destabilizing the whole what they call the deliberate ambiguity about Israel's nuclear weapons program, which of course everybody knows is there, but is not supposed to be acknowledged. Is destabilizing not only to the region but for the whole planet and the whole world, where it is undermining every effort at nuclear disarmament, and it's not only between Israel and Iran, but between, you know, even with the U.S. and Korea and the U.S. and Russia, it affects the whole thing, and it raises great questions. It's very, very destabilizing. But I don't think stabilizing the region is what either Israel nor the United States is after.
Okay. Now, Brian, there are some observers who argue that Israel keeps threatening Iran over concerns regarding the now suspended Vienna talks aimed at reviving the Iran nuclear deal. Now, does this analysis hold water in your opinion?
No.
Richard?
No, because I think it's...
Sorry, Brian, I put that question to Richard. Richard's on the phone. Richard,
okay,
go ahead.
Sorry.
I'm sorry, I thought you were directing that to Brian. Can you repeat that, please?
Yeah, I just said that there are some observers who argue that the concern, the part of Tel Aviv, is that Iran is pursuing this nuclear program, and that the Vienna talks on reviving the nuclear program have been suspended for now. And they're saying that maybe this is because of that Israel is concerned. And does this analysis hold water?
I think that you can see that the Biden foreign policy team, Blinken, and the rest of them are really the neocons. This is the neocons back in power. The fact that Biden said in the run-up to the election that the U.S. would re-enter the agreement, but since then has made additional demands on Iran, which go beyond the scope of what was agreed to when the JCPOA was established, that this is a very hostile government, the U.S. government toward Iran, and for much of the world, as a matter of fact. But I think that, we have to look at the real history of the region, and it's not Iran that's been destabilizing the region. It's Iran that played a key role in the defeat of ISIS in Iran and Syria. And it's Israel which has attacked its neighbors over and over again. It's made war against Egypt. It's made war against Syria, Jordan, Lebanon. It occupies all of Palestine. It pays no attention to international demands to withdraw from territories that were occupied in the 1967 war and is in effect annexed to much of the West Bank and Golan Heights and East Jerusalem, and put Gaza into the condition of an giant open-air prison. So I say all this because it's really, the reality is turned upside down for people in the United States as far as the corporate mass media goes.
Now, Brian, there are some other analysts who argue that Israel's attempt to up the ante against Iran is merely a hollow show of power amid concerns over the U.S.'s dwindling presence in the West Asia region. Let's have your comments on that.
Well, that may be true to some extent, but it's still very, very dangerous. There's no such thing as just blowing hot air in a situation like this. Events can get out of our hands, and it's the world is in a very, very dangerous place. We're in an existential crisis. The organized humanity on this planet. So it's if this is just a game, it's a very, very dangerous and irresponsible one.
Mm-hmm. Now, Brian, how dangerous a game could it be? Could it lead to a war?
Of course it could. Of course it could. And I think that we have to be recognize that as much as we, as most people on the planet, really do want peace, they're very powerful people who don't. Back in January, when the United States was talking about, when President Biden was talking about cutting off the sales of certain missiles to Saudi Arabia over the war in Yemen, the CEO of the Raytheon Corporation, his name's Greg Hayes, he spoke out to the investors of Raytheon, and he said, look, peace is not going to break out in the Middle East anytime soon. I think that it remains an area where we will continue to see solid growth. Continue to see solid growth.
Right.
We're just seeing in Afghanistan that while the president has said we're not going to have troops in Afghanistan anymore, and for now we don't have them, but the over-the-horizon attacks, the drones and the bombers, will continue. And we have evidence that the United States is absolutely aware, from the CIA leaked cables to public interviews by generals, that this is destabilizing and that it is making more enemies than we can kill. General McChrystal had said, when he was still the head of NATO and U.S. forces in Afghanistan, spoke about the drone attacks, and he said, for every person we kill, every innocent person we kill, the United States gets 10 new enemies. Well, in one day last week, the United States garnered at least 130 new enemies through a drone strike on Kabul. But see, that's not considered, General McChrystal and the CIA don't consider this a reason not to have these attacks, because war sounds horrible, but if you have a lot of money in Raytheon, and Raytheon just as one corporation, Lloyd Austin, former general, also former board member of Raytheon, is now the Secretary of Defense. So these people are very, very powerful. And war breaking out to some of these people is their greatest fear. Not what could happen with the war going out of control, but the very idea that somehow some kind of stability and some kind of peace, and that the people of the countries of the region will no longer be markets for their product.
Mm-hmm.
Is a great fear, and they're going to do what they can to keep peace from breaking out.
Right. Now, Richard, the U.S. defense chief said in Qatar on Tuesday that Iranian military activity in the Middle East continues to ramp up tensions. He was actually echoing Tel Aviv's anti-Iran rhetoric, as you see. Whose activities are causing tension in this part of the world, Tehran's or Washington's?
Well, I think that's a very good question, and I think the answer is very clear, that it is indeed Washington. It's not, we don't have a situation where, Iranian warships are deployed off the coast of Palestine, Israel. They're not off New York Harbor, but they are very close to, and these are nuclear-armed ships, submarines, and warships are right off the coast of Iran and throughout the region. And that's the main danger to the region. That's the big problem that the region faces, is the U.S. insistence on being the dominating power in it, with Israel as the junior partner. You would think that given the withdrawal, and I think this goes along with what your other guest is saying, you would think with the withdrawal from Afghanistan, which has been immensely expensive, estimated $2.3 trillion so far spent, $2.3 trillion, and going potentially cost $6 trillion. You would think, well, at least withdrawing from Afghanistan, the military budget would go down a little. But instead, it's going up. The House Armed Services Committee and Senate just added $24.5 billion to a military budget, which publicly is said to be $738 billion already, but is even greater. And what's the purpose of this budget? What is the purpose of this enormous budget that's three times the size of the next largest military budget in the world, that's China? Mm. But probably in reality, if we're honest about the military budget, it's larger than all the other military budgets put together. That's not for defense. That's not to protect democracy when let's talk about countries like Saudi Arabia, which has never had an election, but it's a close U.S. ally. It's for global domination. That's what's going on. And so as the U.S. policies are to eliminate any competition. It's not the people of the United States that are in competition with people of other countries. It's the rulers of the United States who want to dominate, and also those who hold these immense holdings like Raytheon, the immense stock holdings and so forth. For them, war is good. For us, for the people, war is terrible.
Now, Brian, Washington says it's committed to working together with the Tel Aviv regime to enhance regional security and defenses against destabilizing actions. Can you name one single instance where the U.S. restored security to this region?
No. That's a simple answer. No, quite to the contrary. Everything has been destabilizing, and as the other guest said, the idea that we have nuclear warships so close to Iran, as I say, destabilizing does not meet the is not strong enough to say about what the potential of things getting out of hand, and it is, you know, it is being pushed where we're supposedly getting out of Afghanistan, but you know, so that we can focus on our other threats, as Mr. Biden said, with China, Russia, and Iran. And if the United States could not defeat the Taliban after 20 years, we're going to be now you know, ramping up tensions with you know, admitting we're doing this. We're going to be challenging China and Russia and also Iran, and it's it does not look good for anyone. And I have to say about this, you know, the spending, it does not. We are the United States spending more than any other country, more than maybe all of them combined on our so-called defense, is making us less safe. We are one of the countries that has the so-called developed countries that has the least efficient healthcare system. Our infrastructure is falling apart. We cannot feed ourselves. We can't take care of our children. We cannot meet the disasters of the climate emergencies going on all over this country. And it's because all of this money, all of our resources, all our treasure is. All our research is all going into more weapons, and it's only enriching the very, very smallest number of Americans.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, Richard, let me ask you this question. You know, as you definitely have heard, Israeli officials are expressing concerns over what they are calling Iran's nuclear ambitions. Multiple IAEA reports endorse Iran's full compliance with the nuclear deal before the U.S. abandoned it. Tehran then started scale backing, and now it's pledged to go back to full compliance, provided the U.S. returns to the agreement and lifts its sanctions. So this is in no way any good excuse, is it?
No, it's not. And, you know, I think we can see that the Biden administration is trying to take advantage of what the Trump administration set in motion, which is this extreme tightening of sanctions and blocking trade, Iran's trade, with other countries in the world in order to ratchet up the suffering inside Iran in the hopes that it would bring about political change. Or, if not, and I think really they don't believe that will bring about the political change, mm-hmm. will weaken Iran to such a degree that it will be willing, the government will be willing to accept new provisions in order to restore the JCPOA that have to do with other elements of Iran's military, which is really quite outrageous. I mean, Iran's military is nothing, really, in terms of its technical, its technological development compared to the United States. But the United States wants to tell them, no, you can't have this and you can't have that, in addition to the provisions of the JCPOA that were already in existence. And were quite burdensome, really, quite difficult for Iran. And there was a disagreement within Iran about whether or not to. But this is whether or not to accept those. But now it's saying, the U.S. is saying, oh, not on top of those. You have to do this and this and this. And that's what stalled the talks. It's not that Iran is not showing up in Geneva or something like that. The stalling of the talks to restore the JCPOA, which was a promise of Biden that he would do that if elected president, that burden rests with the United States government.
Right. And Brian, the Israeli officials are saying that they are concerned about Iran's regional influence, especially they are emphasizing Iran's activity in the region with an emphasis on Syria. What's the deal with Syria?
Well, I don't think there's much goodwill that the United States has for Syria at all. But I think that the idea of Iran's influence is of course, for good or bad. Iran is in the region. It should have influence. It needs to have influence. A peaceful Middle East, it will not be a peaceful Middle East unless Iran has some influence with its neighbors. And that's just a given. What we should be more concerned about is, like, what is the interest of the United States having the United States Coast Guard has ships in the Persian Gulf. We have no business having that kind of influence, and I believe that this is really part of the fear of you know, peace breaking out. Back to Afghanistan as well. The United States does not want an Afghanistan that's at peace with its neighbors and has that's looking out for the affairs of and the benefit of its own people and having peaceful relationships. Mm-hmm. And fair trading relationships with its neighbors that include Iran and include China and include some of the republics that have very good relations with Russia, which actually is a neighbor as well, is when peace breaks out, the U.S. corporations are going to be, and our oil companies, we're going to be left high and dry. And the United States will need to, at that point, depend on peaceful relations with our neighbors, which we don't really have either. So, okay. So yeah, peace breaking out has to happen. And